With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tusco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and our connection to our own humanity. This is episode 81, another joint episode with Melita Thomas of Tudor Times on Margaret Pohl. Just a quick note that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network, and you can discover lots of great new podcasts at agorapodcastnetwork.com. Remember, you can get links to more information and resources and sign up for the mailing list for extra mini-casts and goodies like that at englandcast.com. So now, let me introduce you to Melita. Melita is a co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history in the period from 1485 to 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. Melita, who has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970s series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, also contributes articles to BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine.
Margaret Pohl, or Pohl, the pronunciation is one of those things that people have been arguing over for centuries. Her actual maiden name, insofar as people use them in those days, was Margaret Plantagenet. She was the daughter of the Duke of Clarence, and so she was the niece of Edward IV and Richard III. And her mother, Isabel Neville, was one of the great English heiresses, daughter of Warwick the Kingmaker. So Margaret was right at the heart of the York family, and like everybody who was born in the 1470s, was tangentially affected by the Wars of the Roses. When she was born, her uncle Edward had been king for, if you exclude the short flirtation with Lancaster in 1471, he'd been king for about 12 years. But Edward and his brother Clarence didn't get on for various reasons, mainly to do with Clarence being overambitious and coveting his brother's throne, probably. So there'd been some difficulty between the two brothers, which eventually ended in Clarence being accused of treason and tried in front of the House of Commons tried in front of the House of Parliament with Edward himself actually laying the charges and arguing the case. Clarence was convicted and executed, possibly by being drowned in a butt of Malmsey, as the old legend is. And Margaret effectively was orphaned at a very young age. Her mother had died in childbirth. Edward seems to have taken his responsibilities to Margaret and her brother Edward, the Earl of Warwick, quite seriously. And so far as we can tell, Margaret was brought up with his daughters, Elizabeth of York and her sisters. It's not absolutely certain. There's no definite records, but that seems the most likely place for her to have lived. And things went on much as they did for young members of the royal family. She was educated to the standards of the time. She could read and write and spoke French and played the virginals. Obviously the usual religious upbringing. Then in 1483, her uncle Edward died. There was the brief reign of her cousin Edward V, and then Richard III took the throne. During Richard's reign, not much information about where Margaret was, probably still with her cousins, but once they'd come out of sanctuary. And in the end of 1485, when Henry Tudor invaded, Margaret was sent to Sheriff Hutton in Yorkshire with her the princesses, the York sisters, Elizabeth, Anne, Catherine. So when Henry VII won the throne, Margaret was brought back to London and probably housed with his mother, Lady Margaret Beaufort. When he married Elizabeth of York, Margaret became part of their court. She was one of the ladies in waiting to her cousin, the Queen, along with Elizabeth's sisters, Anne and Catherine. Then there's some controversy about when Margaret was married. Some historians put it around about 1491, but her most comprehensive biographer, a woman called Hazel Pierce, has argued for it being a bit earlier than that, in 1487. And the husband that Henry VII chose for her was a chap by the name of Sir Richard Poole. Now, at face value, he seems to be, obviously, he was of much lower rank than her. He was only a knight, but he was not just an ordinary knight. His mother was Margaret Beaufort's half-sister. So he was actually a cousin to the king, and he was very close to the king. So although it wasn't a good match from the point of view of a title and money, it did bring her, it kept her within the royal family, and Richard was very much favoured by Henry VII. So perhaps not such a bad match as appears. There was quite a big age gap between them, probably about 15 years. But as far as you can tell, it seemed to have been a happy marriage. And the reason I assume that is that long after Richard's death, Margaret paid for one of the most beautiful Chantry chapels in all of England for them both. And that's at Christ Church in Dorset. An absolutely superb example of late medieval architecture, well worth a visit. And later, she also had new plate and new furnishings embroidered with his coats of arms as well as hers. So all of that would suggest that actually she wasn't unhappily married to him. So during the 1490s, they were in and about the court until Richard became one of the senior members of the Prince of Wales household. So that's Arthur, Prince of Wales, the son of Henry and Elizabeth. And Richard was one of the senior members of Arthur's household. And Richard and Margaret spent a good deal of time in the Welsh marches at Stourton Castle and at Ludlow as part of Arthur's household. During that period, Margaret had several children. She had her oldest son was Henry, very tactful choice of name there. And then there was Arthur, Reginald and Geoffrey, and a daughter, Ursula. There may have been another daughter who died young. And my guess is she would have been Elizabeth if there had been another daughter. Ursula was a name that had been used in the York family. Edward IV had a sister named Ursula who died young. So there they were. They were living in the marches, doing whatever people did in those days. They also had a house at Bochmer in Buckinghamshire and a couple of other properties. And then Arthur married Catherine of Aragon and went back to Ludlow and took up his married life there. Richard Poole was definitely there, and it has always been assumed that Margaret was with him. And it's probably at this time that she and Catherine of Aragon became friends. And there was quite a big age gap. Margaret was about 10 years older, but they seem to have, they were certainly friends later in life. So this is probably the time when they first met. Margaret was widowed in 1504, and Henry VII, I have to say, didn't cover himself with glory in the way he treated her. He was very niggardly about money, which, considering he had her brother's earldom of Warwick, he gave her a very meagre pension to live on. But in 1509, everything changed because Henry VIII became king, Catherine of Aragon lay aside, and Margaret was instantly rushed back to court, became lady-in-waiting to the Queen, and within a couple of years, she petitioned Henry for the restoration of the Earldom of Salisbury. Now, the Earldom of Salisbury had been held by Margaret's great-grandmother. It was one of those earldoms that could be inherited by a woman. Margaret petitioned for it to be returned to her, and in 1513, Henry agreed. So Margaret became Countess of Salisbury in her own right, and it was one of the wealthiest earldoms in the whole country. She had an income somewhere around £2,000 per annum. The Duke of Buckingham, who was the top noble, had around £4,000 per annum. But Margaret's income was greater than that of the Dukes of Norfolk and of Suffolk. So she really was right at the top. And she lived like a great feudal magnate. She had hundreds of manor houses, several castles. She built a great manor house at Warblington in Hampshire, which unfortunately there's just one little tower is left now. She had one at Clavering. She had a London house right where Cannon Street Station is now. And yeah, she lived like a great feudal magnate. And she married her children into the appropriate families. So her daughter Ursula was married to the heir of the Duke of Buckingham, which was the best marriage in the country for a girl. So had things gone well, Ursula would have become the highest ranking woman after the royal family. But unfortunately, in 1520, Ursula's father-in-law, the Duke of Buckingham, was accused of treason. May 1521, Buckingham was executed, and Margaret's son, now Lord Montague, was associated with Buckingham, and he spent some time in the Tower of London as well. Margaret herself had been appointed as governess to Henry and Catherine's daughter, Mary, but she was removed from her post in the wake of the Buckingham affair and under a bit of a cloud of suspicion, because obviously the marriage between Ursula and Buckingham's son started to look a bit suspect when Buckingham was being accused of treason. So Margaret and her family fell under a bit of a cloud. However, at that time, in the early 1520s, Henry was somewhat less vengeful than he later became, and Margaret was reinstated as governess to the Princess Mary in 1525, when Mary, like her uncle Arthur, was sent to Ludlow as head of the president of the Council of Wales and the Marches. Now, Mary was only nine, but so it was Margaret's role to make sure she was brought up properly, educated, had enough exercise, wrote her letters to her mother and father, you was healthy and happy and all those sorts of things. And they were there for 3 years, off and on, between 1525 and 1528. Then in 1528, Mary was recalled to live, and I quote, nearer to the king's person, so unquote. And there's some question as to why Henry decided to bring Mary back. It's possible that it was for her health. She had about a smallpox, so that might have been it. It might have been that, you know, Henry and Catherine were genuinely missing her, as they said. Or it may have been related to the fact that Henry was now seeking to have his marriage to Catherine annulled. And in his own mind, he was going to probably replace Mary with a son who he hoped would quickly arrive when the Pope gave him permission to marry again. Unfortunately, of course, it didn't work out quite how Henry was planning. So there was a long hiatus between 1528 and 1533, when Margaret was still governess to Mary, who was still the king's daughter, the king's heir. And it wasn't until 1533 that Henry demoted Mary after the birth of Elizabeth. So Margaret offered to pay for Mary's household herself, but that was refused, and she was dismissed from her post as governess. And Mary was sent to Elizabeth, and Margaret was basically sent to the country, because her son, Reginald, who had been educated at Henry's expense, wrote the most surprisingly vicious attack on Henry VIII. It wasn't just a case of him disagreeing with the annulment. He wrote a paper that was full of personal abuse of the king, which was tactless, to say the least of it. And because Reginald was safely in Europe, effectively damaged his mother and his brothers. So Margaret and her older son, Lord Montague, effectively disowned Reginald and said, he's ungrateful and undutiful, and he should. And they wrote to him and said, Reginald, you must obey the king. He's your sovereign and your master and so forth. But Reginald, for the sake, he couldn't in conscience agree to the annulment, so he stayed in Europe. There was a rumor that Henry's government attempted to have him assassinated. Now, whether Henry would have gone as far as assassination is debatable, although his government certainly paid for a Scottish cardinal to be assassinated, so possibly he would have gone that far. But anyway, if there was such a plot, it didn't come to anything. But Margaret was now under suspicion, as were her other sons. Montague and Arthur had died, and Geoffrey. Margaret, so far as I have evidence, she wasn't ever actually asked to sign the oaths of supremacy and succession. Some women were, some women weren't, but Montague certainly did. And his brother Geoffrey probably did as well. But Henry knew that they weren't happy with the situation, but they accepted it. So during the late 1530s, so Reginald had written this letter in 1536. During the late 1530s, she occasionally attended the court. After Mary was reconciled to Henry in 1536, there was a general reconciliation of the former supporters of Catherine once Anne was dead. But she wasn't restored as Mary's governess, and she you know, she played a much, much lesser part in court life than she had previously. And of course, she was well into her 60s by now. In 1538, things got worse, and Margaret didn't do herself any favours in that she argued with the king about some property. Now, Henry had restored the Earldom of Salisbury to her, and you could say that, you know, Margaret was standing on her rights, but the king believed that one of the manors she thought was hers was his, and it may have been more sensible for her to just let it go, but she didn't, and she kept arguing over this property matter. Being so tenacious of her rights was probably not a very wise political move. Geoffrey Poole was a foolish man, and he drank, and he started talking unwisely about how, you know, the world was going to hell in a handcart, and writing to his brother who was still in Europe, Reginald. And Cromwell got wind of this, not surprisingly. Yeah, Geoffrey was clapped in the Tower, left there for a couple of months without being questioned to panic, got so distressed he tried to kill himself, but was prevented. And then the more he tried to excuse himself, the more, and his family, the more everybody got dropped in it. So he said that Montague had criticised the king, calling him full of flesh and unwieldy, which obviously Henry didn't want to hear about, and that he was a bad character, and, you know, everything was appalling. And, I mean, you can see the sort of thing, talk. But this was leapt upon as evidence of treason. And as well as Montague being involved was the Marquis of Exeter, Henry's cousin, a son of Catherine of York. He was involved, and it became called the Exeter Conspiracy. Now, there's no strong evidence that there was any real conspiracy, but Margaret's lands were along the south coast. So if Reginald Poole had managed to persuade Charles, the Emperor Charles and Francois to invade, of course, Margaret's lands would have been a very super place for them to land. So although there's no real evidence, you can see that there was enough for a paranoid king like Henry to think that this was actually a real conspiracy against him. Montague was executed. Geoffrey was a broken man and was allowed to go free. Mm. And Margaret was put under house arrest at Cowdray Castle, and she clearly made herself very unpleasant because the Earl's wife refused to stay in the castle if Margaret was there unless her husband was there. So you can imagine that she knew how to make herself difficult. Now, the Earl was very sure that Margaret knew nothing of anything that her sons might or might not have been up to. He described her as having the courage that she was almost a man. She was so steadfast and courageous. But in Tudor minds, that was quite a compliment to be almost a man.
Sure.
And so Margaret was, you know, swore absolutely that she knew of no conspiracy. However, after a while, she was taken from house arrest, and this was a good opportunity to get Salisbury back for Henry. She was attainted by Parliament, which is effectively a declaration that you're guilty of treason without a trial. And off she went to the Tower. All her lands were taken. And having started as a royal princess, fallen down to the bottom of the heap after her father was executed, climbed back up to be Countess of Salisbury, she was now back to being the widowed Lady Margaret Poole, money, living in the Tower at the king's expense. She was there for till 1541. Then one day in May, the constable came in and said, "Madam, today's the day you're going to die." And Margaret was horrified. She said, "She, you know, what was she accused of? She'd had no trial. She'd had nothing. And in fact, even a couple of months before, Henry had sent her some warm clothes in the Tower, so he was possibly weakening. But then there was a rumor of another conspiracy, completely unrelated. But he probably thought it was a good time to polish off Margaret. So she was taken out to the Tower, and butchered by a junior headsman who had no training.
It was quite gruesome, wasn't it?
Yes. Now, I don't know that the story that she ran around the scaffold and had to be, you know, forcibly restrained, I'm not sure that that actually dates from the time, but that is one of the stories that, you know, she refused to lay down because she said she wasn't a traitor. But it's a very distressing thought to think of an elderly woman, you know, nearly 70, to be hacked by a by a butcher.
So can you tell me just a little bit going back earlier in her life? She lost her, well, her mother died, then she lost her father, and then she lost her brother. Wasn't it in part because of the marriage with Catherine of Aragon that Ferdinand kind of asked that her brother be killed because he was a potential figurehead of a rebellion? And can you tell me a little bit about like what happened with that and if she, how that affected her relationship with Catherine, if at all? I find it interesting that these women still maintained relationships even while the men were fighting
each other. Yes, it's strange, isn't it, how they sort of divorced their personal friendships from their familial ties. Yes, if you go back to the Wars of the Roses, Margaret of Anjou and Cicely Neville were actually on much better terms than their husbands. It is strange. But after the Battle of Bosworth in 1485, Margaret's brother Warwick, who was 10 and a half, so coming up to his 11th birthday, he like Margaret was brought to London and housed with probably with Margaret Beaufort, but then he soon found himself in the Tower. Now, Henry VII was a man who liked legality. He was not a secret murderer. He liked everything to be done with at least a show of legality. So Warwick was in the Tower, but he was, not executed or anything. Then, not that that's any excuse, but he was maintained there. And then in the 1490s, along came Lambert Simnel, pretending to be the Earl of Warwick. So Henry paraded Warwick up and down the streets of London saying, no, the chap in Dublin can't possibly be the Earl of Warwick because here he is. And Lambert Simnel's invasion, that collapsed, and Simnel went to turn the spit in the king's kitchen, and Warwick went back to the Tower. Then later there was the Perkin Warbeck rebellion, and Warbeck claimed to be the younger son of Edward IV. And the two were housed next to each other in the Tower after Warbeck went to the Tower. And it was alleged that Warbeck and Warwick got together to try to come up with an escape plan for them both. Now, it's very likely, of course, that this was engineered so that they were trapped, or what's the word, enticed, entrapped into committing an allegedly treasonable offence. And as you say, this was very likely to have been at the instigation of Ferdinand and Isabella, who didn't want this to send their daughter to a country where her husband might be overthrown at any time. So Warwick and Warbeck were entrapped into this alleged attempt to escape, and Warwick was executed. Henry felt guilty about this for the rest of his life, in fact, because he knew it was a put-up job. So he had done a very bad thing. And Catherine, it's said, also felt guilty about it for the rest of her life. So that may have been possibly the reason why she was fond of Margaret and did want to make her life as good as possible. And possibly she may have influenced Henry to grant her the Earldom of Salisbury as compensation, at least in part, for the loss of her brother. Now, and how attached Margaret can have been to her brother is debatable. I mean, she last saw him when she was about 12 and he was about 10. And it was some 14 or 15 years later that he was executed. So, I'm not saying that she wasn't personally distressed by it, but it is unlikely that they had a very close personal relationship. So, but of course the whole situation would be hugely upsetting. One of the most interesting things I found about her was actually how she lived effectively as an earl. She was a female earl. She wasn't just she was a countess, but she had vast lands to administer. She had a council, and this was the common way of doing it, and they administered her lands on her behalf, and she took strategic decisions about what she wanted to hold, what she wanted to keep. But she seems to have taken a reasonably hands-on approach to being a great lord. And she was also considered, to have a place in the household of the Countess of Salisbury was a great achievement for a young woman. So there's lots and lots of letters from courtiers and noblemen saying, please, will you give a place to my daughter? Because there was no better place for them to be brought up if they couldn't get into the Queen's household. Lady Salisbury was next, really, of the great ladies that they could put their daughters with. So it was like a finishing school for her young gentlewomen.
And why did she never remarry?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? My guess is that if I were Countess of Salisbury in my own right, why would I want to introduce a husband into the picture? Because he would instantly have taken charge. So although, yes, she could have had marriage articles drawn up that would have, you know, retained her control, that would have been to make more waves than just to not remarry and continue to control it herself.
I'm surprised she wasn't kind of forced into a marriage, though, to secure her loyalty or something.
But there
like
was
that.
The only people who could have forced her would have been Henry and Catherine. And from Henry's point of view, in the early years of his reign, he was attempting to get on well with his York relatives. I mean, he promoted Margaret and her sons, paid for the somewhat ungrateful Reginald's education. The Marquess of Exeter, he promoted him. So he wanted to get on well with his York cousins. There was probably nobody of a suitable age. And in fact, from Henry's point of view, probably marrying her to another great noble would actually, potentially make her more powerful or him more powerful, you know, the husband more powerful. So keeping her single probably didn't hurt. Now, she was widowed, just looking at how old she was when she was widowed, in 1504. So she was, what does that make her, 27? Yeah, so only in her early 30s, only 31. So, but during Henry VII's reign, he possibly may have got round to remarrying her, but when she was widowed, he had gone into the rather morose period that he went into after the death of Elizabeth and Arthur. Another interesting thing is, as late as talking about the influence she had as a great lady, in 1537, after Mary had gone back to court and and Jane Seymour was queen, Margaret started receiving letters again asking her to make for favours with the queen. So she was asked by Lady Lyle on a Grenville, who we've talked about previously, to find a place to talk to Queen Jane about places for Honor's daughters. So it was instantly assumed that Margaret would once again be influential after the death of Anne Boleyn. But I don't think Margaret had as much influence as Lady Lyle hoped. I get the impression that Henry didn't like her personally, that there was some quarrel, possibly because he thought she was ungrateful, or possibly because she was Catherine's friend. You definitely get the impression there was some personal dislike here.
Well, where can we learn more about her?
The standard biography, which is very, very thorough, is by Hazel Pierce. It's quite an academic work, but it's full of really interesting information about her life as a countess and quite a lot on the Exeter conspiracy, which saw the end of her sons. Go and see her chantry in Christchurch. Susan Higginbottom has written Margaret Poole, a biography. For novels, there's Samantha Wilcoxon's Faithful Traitor, and Lady Salisbury makes quite an important appearance in the old Hilda Lewis trilogy about Mary, which I think is out of print now, but good if you can get hold of a copy. I Am Mary Tudor, it's called.
Thank you again to Melita Thomas for taking the time to tell us about Margaret Poole. For more information on her, go to tudortimes.co.uk or see the resources available on the Englandcast site at englandcast.com. And remember, if you like this podcast, the best ways you can help us succeed is to leave a review on iTunes, or you can tell a friend about it. Seriously, tell your friends to listen. When you're all like at work and you're talking about what you're watching on TV, what you're reading, tell your friends to check out the podcast.
Seriously, you know they're going to like it, so just tell them. It really makes a huge difference to the show, and thank you. So the next episode in about 2 weeks is going to be on some of the more well-known antiquarians and early historians of Tudor England. I thought it was really interesting to think about the people who were already practicing history during this period that we are now looking back at. So we're going to look at some of the chroniclers who've made this period so much more accessible to us than other periods. We'll talk about people like Edward Hall and others like him. So stay tuned for that. All right, thanks so much for listening, and we will talk with you again soon.
Blow, northern wind, a scent will make me sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hörte Bord in Bauerbrick, at Sulis am Lies on Sea.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.